Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, excuse me, and hope everybody had an enjoyable Memorial Day weekend. Of course, that wasn't the case for the families in Uvalde, and of course, all of us commiserating with their loss of those 19 children and those two teachers. But the conversation has turned to reaction to the police's reaction, reaction from politicians, and then, of course, the people's reaction that connects the dots. Steve McGraw is the colonel, who's the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety. And he had this to say about the decision that Uvalde police made to not go into that elementary school when they arrived on scene and heard gunfire.
For the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. That doctrine requires officers. Every officer lines up, stacks up, goes and finds where those rounds are being fired at, and keeps shooting until the subject is dead, period.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You know, we had this with Parkland, too. Remember the Broward County deputy sheriff, Scott Peterson was his name. He was actually charged with multiple counts of child negligence for not going into that high school in Parkland, Florida, when the shooting was occurring. When police make the wrong decision, the Wall Street Journal editorializing over the weekend in reaction to what you heard from Steve McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, in reaction to the outcry against the local police department, in particular, the police chief. Right, the buck stops with him, Pete Arredondo, who made the call to not go in. Before we get to the Journal editorial, here's CNN's reporting. So this is CNN now reporting on Arredondo, who, by the way, a Bobby O'Rourke campaign contributor, we find out.
Officials say this man made the decision not to go in. Chief Pedro Pete Arredondo of the Uvalde School District, PD.
Safety measures were taken to make sure that we had a safe release for the rest of the district, for throughout our city of Uvalde.
A pair of brief appearances in the hours after the slaughter, and Chief Arredondo hasn't been seen by the press since.
Mm-hmm. It isn't clear if charging the gunman sooner would have saved lives, writes the Journal editorial board, but that is what we expect of law enforcement. In the event, a tactical team from Customs and Border Protection arrived, stormed the classroom, and killed the shooter. One of the agents grazed in the head with a bullet, meaning he was half an inch away from death. No doubt police everywhere are asking themselves how they would behave under such circumstances. But the terror in Uvalde is a reminder that, especially in these days of violence, we need the bravest to take those risks, and we need to give them the training and the public support to do so, which is sort of a gentle rebuke of the Uvalde Police Department. There's no question that the story that they thought they had a cornered suspect, a barricaded suspect, rather than an active shooter, it really doesn't hold up under much scrutiny because, of course, you heard the gunfire on scene. You had parents that were trying to get into the school. And I can understand the police wanting to establish a perimeter so you don't have unarmed parents just running into the school willy-nilly. I get that. But there's got to be the response that does two things at once, that one establishes that security perimeter and keeps parents from interfering with the number two effort to eliminate the threat.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Trump was at the NRA convention over the weekend in Houston, where many did not want to follow. Governor Greg Abbott and others suggesting that it would be inappropriate, or they, out of respect for the families of Uvalde, they didn't want to attend the NRA convention. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Trump had something to say, of course, about violent crime, as well as what happened in Uvalde, that mass killing. First on Uvalde.
And clearly we need to make it far easier to confine the violent and mentally deranged into mental institutions. We have also, very importantly, got to deal with the problem of broken families, because no law can cure the effects of a broken home. There is no substitute for a strong mom and a great dad.
Fathers in the home, part of the conversation the left is disinclined to have. He also talked about hardening schools.
Every building should have a single point of entry. There should be strong exterior fencing, metal detectors, and the use of new technology to make sure that no unauthorized individual can ever enter the school with a weapon. No one should ever be able to get anywhere near a classroom until they have been checked, scanned, screened, and fully approved. So important. In addition, classroom doors should be hardened to make them lockable from the inside and closed to intruders from the outside. And above all, from this day forward, every school in America should have a police officer or an armed resource officer on duty at all times. Moreover, at every police department in America, we need a rigorous training on active shooter protocols to immediately locate and eliminate the target. Took too long. And we need to expand funding, recruiting, and training for police departments nationwide. This is not a matter of money. This is a matter of will. If the United States has $40 billion to send to Ukraine, we should be able to do whatever it takes to keep our children safe at home.
You heard the roar there. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What is your assessment of sort of the Trump response to Uvalde as compared to what you're hearing from the Pagliacci's and the Chris Murphy's and the Reparation H's and the big guy? What you're hearing from them is what you normally do, which is, let's ban the instrumentality. Let's go back to a stylized understanding of the days of the assault weapon ban, so-called assault weapon ban, and how that allegedly made America safer, although there's no data to support that actual claim. But data doesn't stop Kamala from opining.
On the issue of gun violence, I will say, as I've said countless times, we are not sitting around waiting to figure out what the solution looks like. You know, we're not looking for a vaccine. know what works on this. It includes, let's have an assault weapons ban. You know what an assault weapon is? You know how an assault weapon was designed? It was designed for a specific purpose. To kill a lot of human beings quickly. An assault weapon is a weapon of war with no place in a civil society.
Our society is so civil. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line, by the way, all weapons were created to eliminate threats. So by that logic about a weapon created to kill people, then, of course, you would be supportive of gun bans generally, which, of course, the left is. They just can't sell that. So they sell the scary weapons, or at least some of the scary weapons that are scary to some, as the way to go. By the way, this is sort of the tenor of the weekend. The some might say unfortunate timing of the NRA convention in Houston. I don't really see why this has to be conflated, why the NRA convention is conflated with the school shooting. The NRA and those who attend the convention are law-abiding gun owners. What does that have to do with some monster who opened fire on a bunch of school children? How many NRA members have been implicated in mass shootings? So why is the NRA drawn into this? Because they're gun enthusiasts, law-abiding gun enthusiasts? Are they the gun lobby? That phrase that the left likes to use so they don't have to confront or more directly insult the tens of millions of gun owners. You know, the people that buy 20 million guns a year in this country. Because that's the order of magnitude we're talking about. So think about the reality, the order of magnitude, when you think about what you're hearing from politicians in terms of public policy prescriptions. Does this address, could this ever address the reality as it exists in America? This was in part the criticism I would have of that grade school drama teacher that the Canadians made their prime minister, Justin Trudeau, who came over the top of the big guy in Kamala, and he's putting a freeze on Canadians and their right to own guns or to purchase any new ones.
We're introducing legislation to implement a national freeze on handgun ownership. What this means is that it will no longer be possible to buy, sell, transfer, or import handguns anywhere in Canada. In other words, we're capping the market for handguns. As a further part of this new legislation, we're also fighting gun smuggling and trafficking by increasing maximum criminal penalties and providing more tools for law enforcement to investigate firearm crimes. And we'll require the permanent alteration of long gun magazines so they can never hold more than 5 rounds. These are actions that doctors, experts, and chiefs of police have been calling for years.
The experts are back. Yeah, okay, well, that's very interesting. I suppose it's a good thing that 1 in 4 Canadians doesn't own a firearm, because with that supply in circulation, this measure you just heard from Trudeau might be misunderstood to be little more than the masturbatory hero fantasy of a repressed grade school drama teacher. But in point of fact, 1 in 4 Canadians do own a firearm. So you're going to put a freeze on it, but you still have that supply in circulation. So what do? You create a black market and you drive up the price. Okay. That changes something materially. If we did that in this country, not that that would pass constitutional muster, I don't think it would, but setting that aside for the sake of argument, Does that sound like a good idea? I know it sounds like something that, you know, suburban p-hats would support, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea or a functional one. This is sort of the point I'm making when I say you have to look at the reality of where we stand today and stop pretending that we're standing at the founding of these countries and deciding how we're going to organize quote-unquote civil society. We're not. So we've got 330 million people in this country and just as many guns in circulation. Now what do you want to do? And what impact will it have? What are you going to do if you banned some scary-looking rifles like we did in 94? What are you going to do with the 25 million scary-looking rifles in circulation? Door-to-door? You're just stopping the putting the Trudeau freeze on them, the manufacture, sale, and distribution, that will prevent a motivated sociopath from obtaining the weapons to kill? You think so? Or why not give it a try? And if we have to sacrifice one young woman who wants to have a firearm to protect herself because she gets home from her nursing job late on the L and she's walking around in Chicago in the early morning or late at night in a city that's been turned over to criminals, she wants to have a weapon, she wants to learn how to use it, she wants to get a concealed carry permit, she wants to be able to defend herself, or defend herself because she bought a condo downtown and she wants to be able to protect herself in case there's a home invasion. We'll sacrifice her because we feel that things like freezing the sale, manufacture, sale, and distribution will do something. Because just do something, whatever that something is. We're back at that place. We always find ourselves in the wake of these horrors, aren't we? Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning, Dan. A while back, Brett Stevens with the Times wrote a piece about the only way to get this done is to actually repeal the Second Amendment. And a couple things. First of all, we can all imagine that getting done in the first place and then saying it got done and getting it done and then enacting it is something that I think is unimaginable. But when the politicians, or be it our Archbishop or the Pope, when they say we don't want to take your guns, they're lying. They do want to take our guns. And things are going to get very interesting in this country. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Yes, Dan. Good morning. Why couldn't they put a monitor over each door and then be able to monitor all the entrances to the doors like people have at their homes? When people monitor when somebody comes at their door, and even if they're not home, they could still view what's going on. That would be a start. I mean, I don't know if it would be totally work, but wouldn't there be more people would they be able to see what's going on at all these entrances and then catch anybody that's trying on it? I mean, that's just a thought.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Rich. Well, I mean, this is sort of what Trump was getting at and others have with respect to hardening these hardening schools as targets. So particularly all that COVID money that was sloshing around security surveillance systems, right, in terms of having a brain center in schools where a school resource officer can monitor all the entrance and exits. I don't know about going into retrofitting schools or one way in, one way out. I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about this at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour with Kevin Brock, formerly of former counterterrorism guy with the FBI. So, you know, I don't, and I also just don't know. I'm a bit unsettled with the idea of turning schools into military installations in terms of the security level. But there have been assessments that, you know, putting a school resource officer in every school in America would cost something like $10 billion annually, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on much lower priorities. I mean, in just some context, the Department of Education at the federal level, their annual budget is north of $40 billion. So you're talking about $10 billion for school resource officers if you wanted to provide federal support for that local expense. Not that it should necessarily be required, but I'm just giving you order of magnitude on the cost. So some of the hardening target stuff makes sense to me. The school resource officer makes sense to me. That's a real inhibitor to any rational person. And remember, just because these people commit atrocities doesn't mean they're not rational, doesn't mean that they don't respond to the situation they're presented in terms of what they're trying to do and how difficult people trying to prevent them from doing it are making it. So if you have an armed guard that's at the ready at a school, that certainly provides a hurdle for any individual who means to do harm. So the hardening target is part of the conversation. I don't think it's a cure-all, but it's part of it. Red flag laws, we're going to go back to red flag laws, and we've talked about these before with the previous massacres. Holman Jenkins has a good piece in the Journal about that over the weekend, too, that the red flag laws are as good as the data, and you also have to decide exactly where you want to stop with the sort of algorithmic assessing of individuals' threat score or social credit score, to put a more positive spin on it. It's a little bit more complicated than just saying, as it always is, pass legislation, red flag law, somebody makes a threat, petitioner can go to court and have that person stripped of their Second Amendment rights. But do we want to get into sort of the pre-crime China model, where you don't have to wait for a petitioner to supply a name? You have big social media platforms, you know, algorithmically monitoring people. And once your social credit score goes the wrong way past a certain threshold, then boom, you're flagged. And you take that, police take that, and they go to court. You know, there's due process considerations here, just our constitutional rights here. If you want to live in a free society, talking not just about the Second Amendment, but also due process and trying to prevent these crimes. Bill in Cape Coral, Florida.
Yeah, good morning. You know, those gun detecting machines that Chicago Public Schools put in, most of them didn't work. And the teachers knew it, and the officer sitting by the machine knew it, but the contract was already made with whoever had the contract for the thing. Those machines were useless after about 6 to 8 months. They were broken. They never even fixed them. They just I went up to the guy that ran for mayor. I can't think of his name, and I told him about it. I said, "Hey, you're running for mayor. These machines don't even work." He goes, "Yeah, I know about it. The Irish guy. I can't think of his name right now, but
Joyce.
Everybody knew that those machines. Everybody knew that the machines didn't work. That's all.
Yeah.
So all this equipment you have, after the contract's there, just like this red light contract and everything else, once they get their contract, they don't care if it works anymore. What you need is more enforcement, and the coppers that had to, they're afraid to do anything nowadays. They're going to have somebody sitting having crumpets and tea in an air-conditioned office 2 days later telling them that they were wrong for busting in there and blowing this guy away. It's just they've ruined the spirit of a police officer. How do you expect them to do anything? It's terrible.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Yeah, I mean, right, the equipment failures, right, that is, again, nothing is foolproof. But, I mean, think about a couple years ago that sort of mystery shopping exercise that TSA went through, right, where they did sort of an assessment of how good are the screeners at catching weapons. And what did they find? Something like 90% plus of weapons that were put through the scanners were missed by TSA. You know, this was an exercise, a training exercise. It wasn't an actual threat, but 90% of the weapons were missed. And so, yeah, I mean, the manipulation or the corruption associated with the contracting as it pertains to things like metal detectors at schools, in addition to, as I said before, the question about if you really want to turn these schools into sort of, you know, green zones within metropolitan areas. Craig Monk Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Thank you for taking my call. You know, they have that little saying, when police are only minutes away when seconds count. And then after Heartland and even these other things, I mean, they already knew this was already discussed before, about basically you get on site and there could be kids that are bleeding out and the active shooter's still going and they still hang around out there. And then the other point on these taking away the guns and the less bullets, where all these politicians and all these people that are always saying all that stuff, all that are armed guards and all of the people that they got there surrounded by with all these tons of bullets and multiple guns and everything like that, let them be under the same damn thing, because they don't want us to be protected, but they want to protect themselves and they don't want limitations on themselves. So it's got two sides of the coin.
Thanks, Greg.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Oak Park River Horse... River Forest High School.
What were you going to say?
Oak Park River Forest High School.
Okay.
The new grading system next year. Transformative educational professional development and grading. That's the plan. Meeting discussed last week. This plan was presented by the assistant superintendent for student learning. Of course, it's like Teldar paper. You got a bunch of assistant superintendents passing paper back and forth in every school district. Of course, OPRF leading the way when it comes to die culture. In an effort to equalize test scores among racial groups, Oak Park River Forest High School will order its teachers to exclude from their grading assessments variables it says disproportionately hurt the grades of black students. They, black students, can no longer be docked for missing class, misbehaving in school, or failing to turn in their assignments, according to the Transformative Educational Professional Development and Grading Plan. Well, that will be transformative. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Although, Amy, I don't know. I don't know if this is not just codifying what it already is.
No. You have to be accountable. You have to go to school, meaning go to class if you're enrolled in school. And you can't, why even bother to go to school if you know that you're not going to get docked any points or docked your grade if you don't show up for school? So they're going to be lenient on whether or not they show up in class and then on the assignment as well?
They can no longer be docked for missing class, misbehaving in school, or failing to turn in their assignments. Traditional grading practices perpetuate inequities and intensify the opportunity gap, according to the Transformative Educational Professional Development and Grading Plan. And so what we need and what OPRF is going to do is competency-based grading, eliminating zeros from the gradebook, encouraging and rewarding growth over time.
That's continuing to perpetuate the victimization of this culture. And, you know, we want to grow strong citizens and good people. How are you going to hold down a job and learn like the discipline of holding down a job if you don't have discipline at school? They don't care. This is just in the here and the now, and they don't care about the future of that child,
rewarding,
that son or daughter.
Encouraging and rewarding growth over time. Competency-based grading, eliminating zeros.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Our text line's open, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
By training teachers to remove the non-academic factors from their grading practices, like turning in your assignment, mm-hmm. That's a non-academic factor, according to these folks. By training teachers to remove the non-academic factors from their grading practices and recognize when personal biases manifest, districts can proactively signal a clear commitment toward DEI, according to the associate director of the Education Advisory Board, which sells consulting DEI consulting services. Right. So that you bring in the DEI consultants and you bring in the Bobs and you get the Bob plan. And the Bob plan here is we'll track your growth.
Do you think that eventually it'll end its way up at CPS? If it starts there, I mean, where are the strong black moms and dads who just see what is going on there and call that crap out and have a protest and say, no, I want my son and daughter to be a functioning member of this society, so we're not going to go along with this. And how dare they even think this up?
Mm-hmm. Is this already the case everywhere, more or less? I mean, be honest with yourselves. This stuff is going on in your school district, isn't it? Give us a call and tell us. I point you to this op-ed posted last week by Tom Stuckel, who used to be an English teacher at Lyons Township High School. So here we have Oak Park River Forest, and we have Lyons Township, two of the great, great schools. These are great high schools. This is why people move to the suburbs, for the great schools. You know, we lived in the city, but then when the kids got of age, we moved to the suburbs for the great schools, really.
Yeah, how many times have you heard that story?
Tell us more about those great schools. Once upon a time, still today? Tom Stuckel. I resigned from my English teaching position after 17 years because I cannot, in good moral standing, teach students well based on current administrative policies. What are those administrative policies? One, homework is not scored. Homework are no longer scored as any part of the student's grade. Because of this, an average of 50% of my sophomores this year consistently did not do their homework. 80% of my seniors consistently did not do their homework. The students know they will not be marked down, so they don't think it's important enough to do, even though doing this work in class and at home is, of course, part of learning and mastering the material. No homework.
LT? LT, where Dr. Nzike's daughter goes.
No due date. The administration forces teachers to not have a set due date on summative assignments, meaning major assignments, essays. If I assign a summative essay to be turned in February 1st, the students know they can turn it in anytime 2 weeks after February 1st, and I can't consider it late. But 70% of my seniors turn in their major assignments late. Revisions. Once I do get their major assignment and I turn it back to them, they have 2 more weeks to decide if they want to revise it for a better grade, even though in my class, English, I go over the writing process with every major summative assignment and give feedback on all their drafts multiple times before they turn it in the first time for the grade. So they go through that entire process. You get multiple shots to get the teacher to weigh in on your drafts. You turn in your assignment 2 weeks late, and then he grades it. He sends it back to you, and then you get 2 more weeks to decide if you want to take one more shot to improve it a final time.
Okay, I have heard of that. I mean, if you take a quiz and you score poorly on the quiz, you can correct the quiz and turn it back in to get some extra points.
Mm-hmm. So homework not scored, no due date. Endless revisions. On failures, Mr. Stuckel, the former English teacher at Lyons Township. Sadly enough, failure is becoming less and less, I believe, for the wrong reasons. Instead of teaching discipline and encouraging consequences for actions, the policies at LT are reinforcing D standards. Dejectedly, 30% of my seniors this year received a D. In the last 3 or 4 years, the administration has made it their duty to limit failures. Of course, they're not taking on the complex issues of why students are failing. They're just papering over the failure. He goes on, because of all these changes and so many more, cell phones in classrooms, a huge distraction. How you allow cell phones in the classroom. I mean, it's just a free-for-all.
I know. I talked to a teacher yesterday. She said, my hardest part in math is getting them off their cell phones. And I tell them, don't text each other in class. Like, well, why do they even have to have the cell phones?
I cannot in good conscience continue at LT any longer. He has this message to parents. Parents, I write this to you, not the administration. I care about your students. I care that they get the quality education they deserve and you expect. Parents, be aware and be proactive to what is happening at your school and your students' classrooms. Quality change will not come from the administration, the board, or even the teachers. The teachers here at LT are wonderful, caring people, but they don't have a strong enough communal voice to fight against lame policy. Parents, it is up to you to make the change you want for your student. Parents, demand that the policies that are harming your children's education change. And dutifully, right after that, Oak Park River Forest instituted those policies and many more, formally changing the grading based on your race. Tell me that's not some of what you heard is not happening at all of these government school systems in the suburbs. Don't lie to me. I know it is. Just admit it. Malcolm in Grays Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, this all reminds me of the remember the Titans, the 1971 football team from Alexandria, Virginia, I think it was. Well, Denzel Washington plays the head coach and plays the assistant coach, and there's and the white guy is taking the some of the black kids aside and making it a little easier for them to get along with everybody. And Denzel Washington says to him, "Stop quibbling them, or making them unfit for the future," is basically what he's saying. If you give them a pass now, they'll be expecting a pass later. I have daughters and daughter-in-laws who are teachers, and the majority of the problem in their classes come from African-American students. My one daughter was in Teacher America. She was a political science and education major, or not education, but something else major. And she went through the Teacher America program. She taught for 5 years in underprivileged schools. And she had mostly Hispanic or black kids. And the black kids always gave her more problems than the Hispanic. So if they're disrupting in class and they're not sending them home, they're disrupting your kids' education too. I mean, I read in the Wall Street Journal this week that 80% of the people coming out of Harvard now are woke. I mean, what a waste of $100,000 education a year.
A year, right.
It's like Dennis Prager says, the more education you have, the stupider you become.
Thanks for the call, Malcolm. Dave, Wakanda. Hey, Dave.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it just goes to show you the content of the character of the teachers that put up with this. I understand they could lose their job, but we lose that person that wrote that letter. That was a great letter, but he sounds like an extremely competent, commonsensical teacher. We lose those types of people, and what they get is replacements of patsies, and that's how it's becoming. These people have no accountability in school, and they will have no accountability in the job force, which will be rechanged to account for DIA. So they're just ruining and making our nation weaker.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Karen Beecher.
Good morning, darlings. Once again, God has spoken to me loud and clear that I made the right decision in leaving education. And I want to say for at least 15, 20 years, you were never allowed to put less than 50% in a grade book. Even if they never turned in an assignment, even if it was 49% or 42%, you had to put in 50%, and that was the end. You could not talk about it. You could offer all sorts of revisions, other opportunities, but if they never took that opportunity up, 50% was the lowest grade they could ever get. Mm-hmm. Now, I just had fifth grade students being passed on to the junior high that I have known since first grade who can't write 5-word sentences. I came to school today. Don't know to capitalize I, don't know the difference between two, two, and two, and have no skills in punctuation. Yet they're being passed on now to junior high. So it's horrifying to know that this is who's going to be taking care of me in my coming twilight years.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Karen.
Some teachers just want to pass the problem on to somebody else.
The point is that here we are again, where the people that these new Marxists think they're helping, they're not helping. I mean, you don't want to educate children. You want to pass kids through the system regardless of performance. You don't want to hold them to any work standard. You want to give them a pass because of their race? Go ahead. Wait, you think you're hurting me and my rich honky friends? No. That's the whole point. I love the left. We're going to show, who are you showing? We're going to show them. Who are you showing? All you are doing is relegating mainly or disproportionately minority children to second-class citizen status. They're not going to be taking care of you, Karen and Beecher. The state is going to be taking care of them. Congratulations. You really stuck it to the man by refusing to equip young children with the skills they need to be successful in life. What an accomplishment. Phil and Darian.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Listen, you know, we all have to look at this in a different way, perhaps, Dan. So if they want to end systemic racism, I believe this is the best way to do it. Wait until the white kids in the class find out that their buddy that's sitting right next to them that's of color, he can get away with anything. You want to end systemic racism? This is the way to do it. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Thanks. Well, you know, I mean, they're also trying to create racial discord where none otherwise does or should exist. I mean, and by the way, do you think that that is a self-esteem builder? It may be fun short-term, long-term. Oh, yeah, those kids or that kid because his race.
Yeah.
That's all.
He didn't
that,
have to try as hard as I did.
That all that kid
color
is
of his skin.
All that kid is his race. You think that's
it what, marginalizes a whole community?
It's, what it builds character. That puts them on a track. That eliminates the opportunity gap. Okay.
And these teachers think they're helping by doing this.
Pat in Lockport.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm just listening to this conversation, so I pulled out my crayons and my poster board, and maybe you can help me, you know, walk me through this. We're paying our tax dollars, the greatest of which on the real estate is for schools. Well, what happens if citizens decide they're going to eliminate that part from their bills? Why do we have to heat a building? Why do we have to cool a building? Why do we have to staff a building when nobody gives two hoops in hell what goes on in that building? If these kids decide that, oh, my God, today I'm going to grace your doorstep, we're supposed to get all excited and then sit on their lazy asses, on their disobedient brains, on their cell phone, and I'm busting my hump at the age of 79 working part-time to supplement Social Security to pay for this. I could do a lot more money with the damn taxes I'm paying that go to these schools. Why isn't there financial accountability from the general public? If I'm not getting what the hell I'm paying for, I'm not paying for it.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Pat. Better ask your neighbors. Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. As a spouse of a teacher, a first-grade teacher, I can tell you that there are so many kids that are dyslexic and have learning disabilities, and the schools aren't proactive in addressing those because the parents aren't proactive in being their children's advocate. So, and this is in white suburbia. Imagine inner city, black urban areas. I mean, unless you advocate for your kids, you're not going to get the help. And unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with litigation. Teachers cannot put a label on kids until they get in much later in grades. And statistics will show you they are lost almost forever by third grade. So if you're unwilling as a school to put parents on notice or get the kids help in first or second or third grade, you are doing this entire nation a disservice.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Well, and again, this is not limited to the government schools. Unfortunately, even some of the best schools are going this direction. We mentioned the story when it happened several months back. My alma mater, Bennett Academy in Lisle, which has shedded its Catholic identity, also is shedding its academic reputation by changing the parameters for grades, widening them for A's and B's. Instead of 93 to 100, it's 90 to 100 is an A, and so on down the line. Who do you think you're helping? But this is the sentimental barbarism. I feel good about it, and they're going to feel good about it, because we're all going to have collectively a false sense of accomplishment.
There you go.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. John Tierney writing over at City Journal, our friend John Tierney, former New York Times reporter. I mean, just some perspective here. There is not an epidemic of mass shootings, says James Allen Fox, criminologist at Northeastern University, who's been tracking mass shootings for decades and actually helps keep the AP USA Today Northeastern University mass killing database. James Allen Fox says what's increasing and is out of control is the epidemic of fear. The odds that an American child will die in a mass shooting at school are nearly 10 million to one. About the odds of being killed by lightning or dying in an earthquake. Those are also about the same odds that any American will die in a mass public shooting like the recent one in Buffalo, writes Tierney. Of course, Tierney understands, as we do, this is no consolation to people who've lost a child or a family member, whether it's at Uvalde or Buffalo, particularly if it could have been prevented. So we have the conversation about what we can do to prevent killings generally, mass killings in schools. We have that conversation. Of course we do. But some proportionality to the discussion is also important, so we understand exactly what the threat level really is before we rush to transform society yet again because we blow the threat of a particular bad way out of proportion. And proportionality is really important in public policy making. I know that's not the order of the day in D.C., but it is. So, yes, we talk about hardening schools. Talk about that. Talk about more school resource officers for what we spend in K-12 education. As I said early in the program, $10 billion to put a school resource officer in every school in the country is not a lot of money. So have that conversation. Sure. You want to
start with locking the doors.
You talk about surveillance, talk about all that, how much you're comfortable or not comfortable with turning these schools into military camps. That's a discussion that's to be had at the local level in every hamlet across the country. But just can we get some proportionality to this before we're freezing the manufacture, sale, and distribution of guns in Canada, and you have Kamala and the big guy and Pagliacci running around with their hair on fire saying, if you don't support this cosmetic ban that we're kicking around, resuscitating and now kicking around, then you don't care about the lives of children and so on and so forth, all of the histrionics. You think that serves a purpose? Is that making us safer? Is that what saves children? The prattling on of politicians inside the Beltway?
New York Times, their front page, they listed 15 mass shootings in which authorities said the gunman was able to obtain the weapons legally.
Well,
so they passed background checks and all of them. I mean,
when we talk about mass shootings, we also don't have a standard definition of what a mass shooting is. These databases that track mass shootings, some it's three more than
more.
No. Some it's more than three people victimized by gun violence. Others, it's more than five people murdered in a single event involving guns. I mean, CBS in Chicago had a report yesterday. You know who leads the nation in mass shootings, according to one way of measuring it since 2018?
Chicago.
Of course,
I mean,
Chicago.
We had 49 shot yesterday. I mean, over the weekend, yeah. The three-day weekend, but 49.
So, every weekend in Chicago is a slow-motion mass shooting.
Right.
So can we just, you know, sort of, I understand the emotional response, and I understand how raw it is and how unimaginable it is, just as it was after Newtown, just as it was after Parkland. I get it. We've discussed
Columbine,
it.
Columbine, all of them.
But the making a spectacle of yourself serves no purpose. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Kevin Brock, former Assistant Director of Intelligence for the FBI, former Principal Deputy Director of the National Counterterrorism Center. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Dan, Amy, how are you?
Good. So first, let's talk about the police response. Colonel McGraw, the Director of Texas Department of Public Safety, said, you know, Uvalde police got it wrong. They didn't go in. You know, particularly after Parkland, I can understand why parents and just Americans following the story are, you know, completely flabbergasted that police hearing gunfire in the school stayed outside the school for an hour. Is there any explanation for this?
Doesn't seem to be, but I've learned over the years that we have to really see what the investigation reveals to get all the extenuating circumstances in every case. That said, it doesn't look good. Most people acknowledge it looks good. Most law enforcement professionals are puzzled at the response. There's a lot of dynamics here involved. I think there has been a little bit of over-rotation on SWAT team tactics and assembly of equipment and coordination of teams coming in. And I had that frustration when I led an FBI office and we'd have a SWAT operation and you know, it took them half an hour to get dressed and get all their equipment assembled and everything else. There's a lot of training that goes into this. Sometimes they feel like there's a need to put in place all the plans, the training, and everything else that can cause delays and frustrations. So I think that has to be examined, particularly in light of school shootings where you have children's lives on the line. The official policy of go and stop and kill the person that's doing the killing is the right policy and should be adhered to as nearly as possible in every situation.
Well, it was a small town. I mean, they didn't have, according to them, they didn't have a lot of resources, but still, you know, the shooter was inside for 77 minutes total. And why in the world would he think that he barricaded? I mean, he did lock himself in that room and they had to go find a key from the principal's office to unlock the door. But as soon as Border Patrol got there, they did not adhere to any of the state officials, you know,
right,
call to stand down, and they went in there.
Right. So again, you're talking about protocols. There's 18,000 police agencies in this country. These shootings have been going on since Columbine for over 20 years now. We know the kids are getting killed in schools. We know that this is a problem that's not going away. In fact, it's increasing. Last year, it was a record number of school shootings, and this year we're on pace to break that record. So this is not a new phenomenon. Police departments should be prepared for these eventualities, should have training for it, and everything else. And to Dan, the point you were bringing up earlier, the national level conversation on this by the national level politicians is worthless. It adds nothing. We've had 20 years of hearing enough is enough. That's our policy. Enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's being done to stop the killing of children in school. I disagree with a little bit of the study that you cited earlier. This guy saying, well, in proportion, it's still safe to send your kids to school. It's not safe to send your kids to American public schools right now. It is not. The trend lines are not good. I know odds are, yes, your child is not going to be killed in a classroom during their 12 years of public education. But there is enough of it going on around the country, everywhere in the country, to where if I'm a parent, I'm wondering whether I have to make an assessment as to whether that's an acceptable risk to allow my child to go to school. And even though it may be a lightning strike, I don't think that's acceptable. And the other point is that how many shootings have we had on airliners since 9/11? None. Mm-hmm. Because we made a determined policy to make sure that cannot happen. A school is a contained environment like an airplane. It can be hardened, it can be made rendered safe, and children can be protected. And yet these things are continuing. So something is not right here,
Dan. Well, yeah. The airline argument is being made, actually not even since 9/11, going back to the hijackings of the 70s. Right, and when all the equipment then came into the airports and the screening and so forth, and suggesting that we can do that in the culture writ large. Well, you don't have outside individuals boarding a plane once it's in flight. The idea that there's screening to be done airport style for all public venues in America or something like this. I don't even know what the actual proposal is. I just know people are making appeals to, we had all these hijackings in the 70s, and then we instituted the screenings and the checks and the layers of security, and then the hijacking stopped. Okay, well, so translate that into America writ large. What is the idea here?
Well, again, you're not going to be able to harden every soft target, but a school is a contained environment that can be sealed.
Yeah.
This can be done, and it's not being done, and it basically translates into a policy that we have zero tolerance for gun violence on an airplane, but we will tolerate a certain amount in our schools.
Well, but when so harden the target, and the zero tolerance policies too. You know, here we get into the actual operation. Zero tolerance policies have kids being expelled when they, you know, use their index finger and thumb to make a gun. And this is where it goes off the rails and people start using common sense. And now we're going the opposite way, where kids are not getting punished for misbehaving because, we've got to do rate diversity and inclusion and equity. So, I mean, it's such a intellectual mess because it's driven by ideologues rather than pragmatic people, I guess, in part. But when you talk about hardening schools, are we talking about school resource officer? Are we talking about surveillance? Are we talking about metal detectors? Are we talking one point of entry? What are we talking, bulletproof glass? What are we talking about?
A lot of that. Certainly school resource officers, although most schools have, if they have one, they're lucky. Certainly controlling ingress and egress to the school, screening of people coming in and out of the school. All of these things are, yes, inconveniences, impacts on the culture, creating a situation where it's a hardship on everybody, which we have done for air travel, but we all accept it now because we don't want to crash and die. So, if I'm a parent, I would be smothering the school board and the town council in my town with demands to know, what are the plans? What are your plans to guarantee that my child is not going to be shot and killed in your classrooms? And if they're going to find that the plans are largely inadequate. So if they find that to be the case, then they should be making the demands locally, ignoring the national politicians who are stuck like a broken record on gun control and intervening in mental health issues predictively. All of this stuff is pie in the sky. That's not going to impact the problem at hand, and that is kids are being shot and killed at schools.
Yeah, but
so
the mental health issue. I mean, this Texas shooter, we're not saying his name. I mean, over the weekend, one of his friends came forward with this disturbing video saying that he liked to hurt animals and he'd kill cats and carry their bloody, carcasses around in a bag and just to laugh and to show people and to show off. I mean, why didn't anybody in the community come forward like, this is wrong, because you start with small animals and then it could lead to something else?
And Amy, what the intelligence has told us over the last 20 years is that these troubled young males, they're all young males that do the shooting, have emitted signals ahead of time, either to friends or social media or other signs that they're going to act out violently. This does present an opportunity to interdict ahead of time. And a lot of that has been done in many cases. But it's still an imprecise problem. And a lot of the tools that law enforcement could exploit to analyze that kind of data and get those types of heads up are being resisted by civil liberties and privacy advocates who don't want things like algorithms that can scrape social media. They don't like facial recognition. They don't like other tools that can help stop crimes. Although that has its place, and we have to be careful about technology overrunning rights, but there's this tension in the country right now between capabilities that could help prevent bad things from happening and an overstepping from a technology standpoint on individual rights.
Well, right. I mean, this is the conversation surrounding red flag laws. And I got to say, mm-hmm. part of the problem now is sort of the political chickens coming home to roost when it comes to law enforcement, particularly federal law enforcement. The loss of faith in the FBI among half the country, the defund the police movement among some percentage of the other half of the country. So you have a lot of antagonism directed toward federal law enforcement and even state and local law enforcement. And that paralyzes us when we talk about law enforcement and try to intelligently balance these competing interests, as you were describing.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, it's making sure that there's not an over-rotation, but you're exactly right. All of these understandable reactions to law enforcement oversteps, both the federal level, FBI, my old agency, we're paying for the sins of individuals who acted badly. And but we need to learn from that. Law enforcement should never be immune from criticism and examination on a daily basis. It has to happen. Uvalde should not be afraid to be evaluated for the steps that they failed to take or did take during that time period. We learn from that and we move forward. This is something that is prudent at this time.
Kevin Brock, former Assistant Director of Intelligence for the FBI, former Principal Deputy Director of the National Counterterrorism Center. Kevin, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And he joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Justin Trudeau, that grade school drama teacher the Canadians made their prime minister. We'll see the big guys call for a renewed assault weapon ban, which is the prohibition of some scary-looking rifles, if you remember that 10-year period from 94 to 2005. He'll see that assault weapon ban call.
And
he'll raise you.
We're introducing legislation to implement a national freeze on handgun ownership. What this means is that it will no longer be possible to buy, sell, transfer, or import handguns anywhere in Canada. In other words, we're capping the market for handguns. As a further part of this new legislation, we're also fighting gun smuggling and trafficking by increasing maximum criminal penalties and providing more tools for law enforcement to investigate firearm crimes. And we'll require the permanent alteration of long gun magazines so they can never hold more than 5 rounds. These are actions that doctors, experts, and chiefs of police have been calling for years.
The experts have weighed in. The number of murders in Canada, 38 million people.
Yeah, what is it?
Fewer than in Chicago on an annualized basis. But Trudeau is taking the opportunity of the Uvalde school shooting last week, that horrific event, to move the agenda that he actually wants to move as a ideological socialist, which is to prohibit gun ownership. So we'll freeze you now, and we'll come for you later because some estimates suggest 1 in 4 Canadians have a firearm. So what are you going to do with those millions of firearms in circulation if the existence of guns is the issue? For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Richard Epstein, the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, very nice to be here.
What about, pick your proposal, the Biden proposal to renew the assault weapon ban that sunsetted 17 years ago now. The Trudeau policy to take it one step further, not that it could pass constitutional muster here, but certainly is on the minds of some congressional Democrats, to put a freeze on manufacture, sale, distribution.
Well, I think the first thing you have to ask is, the further away you go from the shooting, the more likely it is you're going to stop activity, which is either neutral, i.e. hunting for pleasure, target shooting, and the like, or beneficial, for example, the use of guns in self-defense. So the first question you'd want to ask, given the numbers that you just read, is if there was 100 deaths in Canada from shooting weapons by criminals, how many deaths have been prevented by guns that have been held by people who've been able to use them in self-defense? One of the things that we do know is that a rational, I use the word in quotes, pervert, a gun killer determined on killing many people will pick a soft target. That is a place where he's confident that nobody will be having guns who could resist him. If schools are gun-free zones, that's the place in which you're going to go. Schools are also extremely effective as a target because they're very difficult to keep secure. What happened in Uvalde, of course, was one teacher left a door open through which this thug and miscreant was able to enter into the building. Well, how do you stop that when you have 100 teachers and 1,000 students in any particular kind of facility? It's an open question. So the first question to ask about this is, notwithstanding the applause and the rhetoric, what do we expect to be the anticipated direction of the number of deaths that take place if the ban will put into effect? And given the fact that we're starting from a very low base and that there are, as you said, 2 million of weapons that are still out there, many of which could be stashed, all of which could be modified to defeat the ban that Trudeau wants to put into place, my prediction is it will result in more loss of life than the current type of situation. And so it's extremely important to remember that when people are talking about legislation of this sort, the law of unintended consequences always holds. You do a statute for one particular purpose, and you may be able to achieve it, sort of, but there's an unintended consequence which may be more important and move in the opposite direction. So the real lesson to learn under these circumstances is, before you start to go in very strong directions, either one way or another, what you have to do is to think about not only the things that you want to happen, but the things that are likely to happen, to think less in terms of dogmatism and more in terms of the kinds of trade-offs that you're going to have to face. And so I think it's much important to realize that in this debate, you don't win anything on a question of means to preventing various kinds of harms by announcing that you too are against murder. One of the things that we know is sanctions against the people who commit murder sometimes are going to work. But it is very ironic to say, well, the way we're going to cop certain killings is to use the death penalty, when in fact these guys commit suicide anyhow. So it's just a very, very difficult kind of question. And my general view is exactly the opposite of Trudeau's. You look at the particular sites where people are coming and figure out what it is you could do to harden them. So that way you don't have to interfere with the use of guns that are done by good people, some of whom may come to your aid, rather than to start at the other end of the chain of distribution and to hold people responsible when they sell firearms for the consequences that take place when they're in the hands of maniacs who may or may not have altered the way in which the guns have been used, may or may not have stolen the things, may or may not have used knives along the way in order to secure what they're doing. So I think what happens, there's no dose of sort of sensible realism of what's to go on. And I think it's a tragedy in a debate like this to have moral indignation unless you're really positive that it's going to lead to fewer deaths. And you cannot say that with confidence about the Trudeau proposal. So maybe you want a more limited proposal. The one that I think I would not oppose, I'm not so sure it will do any good, is the question about a ban on the sale of assault weapons to people under the age of 21. I don't see that as sort of crippling the market for self-defense. I don't see that as having huge negative consequences. And we do know, and I think it's pretty clear, that the most dangerous men are not men of 21 to 24. They're people between 18 and 21. What happens is when people start getting a little older, they go to graduate school, they get themselves a job, they have a home mortgage, they slow down the hormones a bit. They're much less likely to do really crazy things than somebody who's 3 or 4 years younger. So want to do that? I don't think it's going to be hugely effective. Why? Because people know how to modify weapons. They know how to get them in the secondary market, which is extremely important, right? They know how to steal them. And so if you're truly determined, the gun which you bought today may be the gun that you will steal tomorrow. But if somebody wants to do this, that's not where I'm going to draw the line. It seems to me that what has to do is to worry not only about the sort of the technicalities and the consequences of various forms of regulation, but the political realities associated with these situations. And if you make a small concession, which is not particularly harmful and maybe modestly beneficial, hopefully what will happen is you won't get these really extreme proposals going through, which could cause a huge deal of difficulty. Let's be very clear about it. If you tell people that they have to turn in their weapons, honest and God-fearing and lawful people will do that, and criminals and thugs and madmen will not. So what will happen is the ratio of guns in the hands of bad people to good people will start to go up. And when that starts to happen, it's more likely that the bad people will use the guns that they have because they're less likely to face consequences from people who know how to do
well. And also, I mean, and that's not just a laboratory experiment. That was the experience in places like Chicago when there were handgun bans in place.
Yeah. Well, Chicago is a murder capital of the world. And it also has a very strong gun situation in terms of the prohibition. But these boundary lines turn out to be porous. And, I mean, you may have to register a gun if they find out about it. And lawful people will do that. But other people who want to engage in criminal activity are certainly not going to tip their hands by telling the law enforcement folks we don't do it. So then you're going to have to figure out how you're going to enforce a requirement that says you can only buy a gun without with a license when it turns out you have no idea where to go. At this point, you start getting the civil liberties question coming up again, which always arises in these cases. Can the government, for example, in Canada, with a man like Trudeau, say, you know what we're doing? We now have a ban. We're going after existing guns. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get a national search warrant so that we can go into everybody's house and rip the place open, demand that they open their safes, their secret cabins, and all the rest of that stuff, so we can find out whether they're having guns. I mean, this is a serious issue that you have to worry about. And we know that Trudeau is basically an authoritarian at heart because the way in which he treated the protesters in the COVID situations, pretending they were terrorists when in fact they were protesters of one sort or another, indicates that he has that kind of a tendency. And one of the things that I worry about more than anything in politics is single people creating a real mood of hostility and terror, which allow them to act unilaterally. I don't like Mr. Putin at all, and I don't want to see Mr. Trudeau aspiring for that level of unilateral power in a prime minister. The system of separation of powers, checks and balances, and so forth may be an irritant in good times, but it is the single strongest protection that you have against things going badly awry
in bad times. Don't you think people in Canada are going to fight back against this suggestion by Trudeau?
Of course they're going to fight back, but the question is fighting back and winning are two different things. And you put a really extreme position on the table, and you heard the thunderous pause in the background on this. That means that the political debate is going to be moving more in his direction rather than the other way around. And so you still have the problem that you may get a compromise, and that compromise will result in fewer extra deaths than the situation that he proposes. Because, I mean, what happens when you listen to people that is they never say what if. They never do the counterfactual. The important thing is they're kind of two kinds of intellectuals. They're lumpers and they're splitters. And lumpers are like people like Trudeau. You talk about something, and by God, the moment you talk about your end, all your means are done. I'm much more of what we call a splitter. You see a big proposal, and you break it down into its constituent steps and see whether or not each of these can actually work. And there's no splitting. And political rhetoric never works in a language of doubt and skepticism. It works much more in a kind of movement mentality, which is the thing of which Trudeau was a master. That's why he's so dangerous on all of this type of situation.
Well, and he's not the only one. The debate that's raging in this country as well. I'll give you an example, because you're involved. Richard Painter, who's a law professor at the University of Minnesota, he was a lawyer in the Bush White House. Here, he dug up an article that you wrote for the Hoover Institution back in 2014 about the futility of gun control, which actually bears out. But he tweeted, here's another shill with blood on his hands. Richard Epstein argued that because most murders don't involve guns, we don't need gun laws. And then he also said something about your scholarship on COVID. But
That always comes up.
Yeah, right.
This is kind of irresponsible. I reread that article as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was trying to be extremely careful. This is not a debate over guns. It's not that I'm in favor of having more people killed. I'm in favor of trying to make sure that you get the right mix. And so to sort of say that somebody's got blood on his hands is a kind of irresponsible rhetoric, which is sort of mindless, and he should be ashamed of himself for talking like that. If he's got something he wants to say as to why it is that I think you're wrong on your calculations, that's fine. So if you can give a carefully controlled empirical study which says, you know, that the self-defense use of guns is relatively infrequent and the aggressive use is much more important, then you start to listen. And in fact, a lot of this may be dependent on how many guns you have in society. So if it turns out you've got none and you have a gun ban, you don't have all the problems about what you're supposed to do with residual weapons that are already out there. And then if you have only one gun and it's in the hands of a perfectly virtuous person, you may be pretty good. But if you have only one gun, this is what you have to think about. People are going to start killing by running cars into schoolyards, right? Maybe we ban cars because they could be done that. They could take hammers. They could take knives. They could take screwdrivers. The number of barehanded killings were great. So what I said in that particular article, and the numbers are roughly constant today, is that if you actually look at the total number of deaths, two-thirds are done by handguns and a much smaller fraction being done by these various kinds of assault weapons. But you still have a third, which is divided between gun killing, strangling, blunt instruments, bare hands, and so forth. And what will happen is those will go up. It will not be a one-to-one ratio. We're not going to be confident about that. But the idea that somehow or other, if you want to say somebody has blood on his hands, because he's advocating something which may or may not be correct, wanting to do more research, then somebody who says, I'm against all this stuff and the murder rate goes up, they've got blood on their hands in the same rhetoric. You just don't need that kind of talking. What you do need is you got to worry about things. So do you have guns in schools, right? Fair question. Well, I certainly don't want 17-year-old kids bringing guns into school. I'm not even sure I want untrained teachers to carry these weapons. But there are a lot of people who are former policemen, former military officers, former security guards. And it was known that some of them had guns, keeping it on their persons. You don't want to put it in drawers and stuff like that. And that would be a pretty effective deterrent in at least some cases. It means that you don't have to wait 4 minutes for a police to come, assuming that they get that right. You wait 5 seconds for somebody to show up there. And what happens is the moment you do that, you get a distraction at the very least. People get a chance to make it to the exit. You slow down things until reinforcements can come. It may work. And in fact, in places like Israel, where they always have a gun mentality because of the Arab risk and the Palestinian terrorist risk, there are very few killings in schoolyards because everybody knows it's a death trap for the people who want to engage in that kind of aggression. Can you do this in the United States? Well, people said, you know, wait a second. Children would be just terrified to know that there are people with guns around them. Well, they're not terrified with police on the street who have those guns. The guy in the schoolyard had a gun, but he was so incompetent he did not know what to do with it. So I would think in a case like this, your first line of defense is you go back to figure out how your school guard systems work, how these people are trained, how they're deployed, how they communicate with the rest of the system, and tighten all of this stuff up. I also think that in a place like Chicago, where they have a consent decree which stops stop and frisk, they have to reconsider that. Anybody who's interested in that should go back and read the great opinion that Chief Justice Warren and the great opinion that Justice Harlan wrote in a case called Terry versus Ohio back in 1969. Right. And, you know, here you get these two determined civil libertarians, and what they come to the conclusion is if you're asking somebody to just stop, then you can't possibly say don't frisk, because they could have a concealed weapon on them. And so what you do is you risk certain indignations and certain offenses against civil liberties, but the consequence is being able to disarm people who might cause various kinds of mayhem. Now, what does this mean? It means since it's such a difficult choice that you have to have extremely good police management on these issues. And I'll make this as a general proposition. When you're looking at guns, and various things like this, lawsuits are not the answer. You have to have really effective, in-place, professional police management on all of these issues so that you have uniform protocols, interactability between various individuals and so forth, and you could deal with this. And what the police commissioner or the head did at the site in Uvalde, Texas, was criminal. I mean, the first rule you learn from anybody, and I'm no expert in this area, they tell you, if you know there's a killer on the loose inside, you don't wait for reinforcements, you go in there. Because, right. You know, if they've got a semi-automatic weapon, which they may have made or they may have bought, they can kill, you know, 10 people in a minute.
Well,
you
right.
just can't sort of sit around there saying, well, I'll wait for reinforcements. You have to break that door down, have to create distractions, have to create a bit of uncertainty in that fellow so he has to look around, at which point it may be that 5-10-year-olds could actually jump them and bring them down, right?
And,
I mean, you know.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned it was criminal, and you're not just saying that metaphorically. We saw the school resource officer at Parkland who failed to enter the
Scott
school.
Scott Peterson.
He was charged with multiple counts of child negligence, so we'll see if that happens in Uvalde
duty.
As well.
I mean, when you're a policeman, you're supposed to take risks. Not because we want you to die, but because we know that if
policemen
don't take risks,
right.
many more civilians will die. And this is the great problem. I mean, are you going to shoot down an airplane, right, which is about to crash into a building, which means you're going to kill 100 people? And the answer is, of course you're going to shoot them down, because they're going to die in 2 minutes anyhow if you don't, and they'll take another 1,000 people with them. So the use of deadly force under circumstances of necessity is one of the most profound questions you ever have to face. And you can face it by making denunciations of people whom you disagree with.
He is Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, take care. My pleasure too, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And just on this matter of Illinois growing again under Governor Spaulding, this is a claim he's making despite the fact that the Census Bureau has rebuked his interpretation of their audit, the auditing of the count they did in the several states.
He's not going to admit it.
And despite the fact that we continue to get numbers on an annual basis, it's been this way for a long time, like we did from the IRS on 2020 migration patterns. In 2020, Illinois, according to IRS tax filings, lost 101,000 people, rounding up from 100,921. So 101,000 people. Who represent an adjusted gross income. This is just income. This is not wealth. Of $9 billion. 100,000 people, $9 billion in adjusted gross income just in 2020. By comparison, just to give you some context, Florida gained 166,000 people and $24 billion in adjusted gross income in 2020. Texas gained 133,000 people and $6 billion in adjusted gross income. Arizona gained 80,000 people and almost $5 billion in adjusted gross income. California lost 263,000 people, lost $17 billion in adjusted gross income. Do you see what's happening here? The red states, people are migrating. This is an old story, but I'm going to keep telling it. there is a bifurcation going on in this country with people who have the ability to be mobile, moving to red states at the expense of blue states. And the particular beneficiaries are Florida, Texas, Arizona, Tennessee, and the particular losers, California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey. It's a story we've been telling for, as I said, at least a decade. But there are a lot of late adapters. A lot of people who come to this party late, an understanding of what's going on, are just now looking around saying, what happened? What's going on in Chicago? Something that's been happening for a long time, but for some people it takes a while to penetrate their consciousness. Tad, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Seems like Governor Spaulding has an increasingly difficult case to make that Illinois is flourishing under his leadership.
Yeah, you know, he's got a difficult case to make. He'll keep making it, and he'll have a lot of the press backing him up. But the facts, you know, the facts on the ground, and you take a place like IRS, which has very hard data, tax returns, and, you know, the data is damning. And it, like you said, it's not just a one-year thing. This has been going on. You know, we tracked the last 20 years of this, and the losses of people and the losses of that taxable income just keep piling up. And, you know, it's having a big effect on the tax base, and it's having a big effect on who's here, right? We're losing, if you look at the numbers, we're losing our wealthier people, and whoever does come here makes a lot less money. It's a lose-lose situation for Illinois.
You know, it's another piece that you had is an important one, because you have these Mercedes Marxists and Chardonnay Antifa types in the suburbs that buy the left's racket here in this state. You know, we're a net donor to D.C. We send more money to D.C. than we get back. And so these deduction caps that that Trump put in with his tax reform bill, unfair to the leftist, the wealthy leftists, I repeat myself, in places like Illinois, which is why we need to lift those caps on things like deducting property taxes. Well, it turns out Illinois, maybe once upon a time when it was a growing state, was a net donor. Not so much anymore. Now it's a welfare queen.
Yeah, you know, you can't just these net last IRS numbers said that we lost 2%, the equivalent of 2% of our taxable income to other states. I mean, that's a massive number. And if you do that year after year, you're hurting your ability to raise revenues. And it's precisely what's happening. And so now this latest study on which states give more money to the federal government versus on a net basis versus take, you know, Illinois is now a taker. And you know, as those migration numbers get worse, we're going to have to take more and more. And, well, you can imagine it's just the wrong way to go.
And what about, you know, we're the highest gas tax in all of the country, especially over Memorial Day weekend. I know a lot of people chose to actually fly because it was cheaper than to drive. But Pritzker's got this thing that it's a law that you have to put the sticker on saying that we're going to freeze your gas tax until December, January.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most absurd laws you can hear of, right? He wants us to brag. He wants gas stations to help him brag that he's going to freeze one of his tax hikes, which will be 2 to 3 cents in July 1st. But he's not telling those gas stations to put up that he's basically doubled the state gas tax since he's taken office. He's doubled it from it's basically 100% increase in the gas taxes. So he's responsible for that, and he's responsible too for a lot of the he's contributed to the bad policies that have raised gas prices. He's been a huge fan of bailouts, which has created inflation. He's been a huge fan of the green energy bill, which has helped bring down our energy independence. And so he's behind his policies and his direct actions on the taxes have had huge implications on Illinois paying the second highest gas taxes. And we had $5 a gallon this past weekend on average. So people are feeling the pain of the pump, and he is directly responsible for that.
Well, in addition to forcing gas stations to be in-kind contributors to his reelection campaign, which is what he's doing, also just to make clear, because that top line by the dolts in the Chicago press corps freezing the gas tax, he's freezing the gas tax after doubling it. He's just not allowing the inflationary increment to be applied for, at present. But But that's not stopping the that's not going to change the trajectory of gas prices and tax burden in Illinois in the medium term.
Yes, we wrote a piece this morning about that gas tax and kind of the anatomy of the gas tax. People should read it and understand all these layers of taxes that are coming on. And so, you know, Governor Pritzker is trying to act like he's doing something about it by stopping a tax hike from going into place in July 1st, one of the ones that he passed back in 2019. But what's ignored there is you know, we have these sales taxes on gasoline. We're one of a few states to do that. So, you know, think about it. It's a 6.25% gas tax. And so as gas prices go up to record levels, the tax on gas keeps going up. And so, you know, when people are hurting even more, Governor Pritzker's tax policies are hitting them even harder. And, you know, we're paying almost a dollar a gallon in gas taxes overall between state, local, and federal. It's huge. It's almost 25%, and it makes no sense. And yet he's out there bragging about his freeze of an increase. So
something else, too, direct result of Green New Deal policies at the state level. We talk so much about it at the federal level. How about the state level and how it actually is visited upon Illinois families negatively? You're talking about the cost of energy, talking about at the pump. How about the reliability of electricity this summer? Good piece by in the Journal over the weekend about the summer of rolling blackouts because of Green New Deal policies. Subsidies enable wind and solar generators to turn a profit even when the supply of electricity exceeds demand. Coal and nuclear plants, of which Illinois sports the most in the country, the nuclear piece, can't make money running only some of the time, so many have shut down. Natural gas fire plants can help pick up the slack, but there aren't enough of them to back up all the renewables coming on the grid. And you had in this piece the CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, Mark Densler, say, we don't have the opportunity to just shut down a facility for 4 hours or 6 hours or 8 hours a lot of the time. If you're making certain products, take a food product, for example, you can't just shut down and have that food remain online as places in central and southern Illinois in particular are looking at being part of the summer of rolling blackouts.
Yeah, I mean, that's effectively a part of our gas price piece. Governor Pritzker and you know, his the people with him, the big green energy people, have touted, you know, they went to the United Nations Climate Change Conference last year, and they bragged, you know, Pritzker bragged about the leadership, quote, leadership role by establishing a nation-leading climate action plan in Illinois. You know, he's been part of making it more difficult. Who would have thought that Illinois would be in the same list as California on potential brownouts? But here we are because they've gone so fast on moving to green energy that they haven't really thought about whether when they shut down a lot of the coal production and you know made it more difficult to have natural gas production, that now we have the chance of having brownouts in southern Illinois. That's fascinating and scary.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Going to talk about the fentanyl overdose crises, the attendant crises surrounding the number of fentanyl overdoses last year with Casey Mulligan in a moment. And this sort of dovetails into this conversation that was the subject of the weekend interview in the Wall Street Journal that featured Edward Glaser, who's the chairman of Harvard's economics department. The question is, can America's cities make a post-pandemic comeback? So that would certainly include Chicago. Edward Glaser, Professor Glaser, said that...
Is it possible?
Well, if you take the U.S. as a whole, office attendance, for example, you know, which drives big city vibrancy.
Right.
Office attendance is down about 19% relative to pre-pandemic levels. There's some wide variation. Houston is at the mean 19%. L.A. is at 21%. New York and Boston are down 32%. San Francisco, 52%.
Oh, my gosh.
The tech hub is the most extreme, he notes. And so,
I think we're at 60% here.
So what happens if getting back to the office doesn't happen? He says, some, perhaps those in late stages of their career, their careers may settle for going fully remote. It's not absolutely necessary that every employee gets back into an office, but I will say, he says, Professor Glaser, that it's going to be very difficult for cities if it doesn't happen. Very difficult for cities if you're looking at 60 to 80% of your workforce returning to your downtown office. For more on the fallout from pandemic policies, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Casey Mulligan. We'll see your Harvard and we'll raise you a University of Chicago where he teaches. He served as the chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 2018 and 19, and he's the author of You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy.
So what do you think about Professor Glaser's observations about office vacancy rates, employees, the percentage of employees not returning, and what that means for at least the near future of big urban centers around the country?
I think he hit it right on the head. Actually, that was his University of Chicago dissertation dealing on the combination of the topic of cities and what he called human capital. This is a big problem for young people. I mean, the normal mode of working is you'd join a company, whether it be a white collar or a blue collar company, and you would work with older people who would show you the ropes. And now, at least in the white collar sector, those older people are staying at home and not interacting with the younger people. This is totally shortchanging the younger people.
Yeah, but the younger people don't want to go to work either. They want to work remotely so that they could, you know, start their vacations earlier or just,
yeah, but they don't know any better.
Do their pajamas, you know, work in their pajamas. Right, because maybe they don't know any better, but that's, you know, part of the problem too, don't you think?
Yeah, they need to be aware of what they're missing. You know, I've seen that among our own students and alumni. At first, they thought, oh, pajama party. But they started to realize that what they were missing out on. But certainly that information needs to get out there. And maybe it's a catch-22 because there aren't older folks to advise them that they need to interact with the older, experienced people.
Have you looked in any depth at sort of what is going to happen to big cities if you have vacancy rates like we're talking about with respect to office space, but also if you have significant long-term reductions in the use of public transit, other impacts from these lockdown policies that, you know, we're just starting to make assessments of as the water has receded and we see what's washed up?
Well, actually, Glaser and I, maybe it's about 20 years ago when kind of internet was really making the move, and there was a lot of talk of, well, this is the end of commuting. People aren't going to use cities anymore. And there's truth to that in some industries. But then there are lots of industries that would like to be engaged in the city, and they couldn't because they couldn't afford the rent. So I think what you're going to have is other industries making a presence in the cities that weren't there before. Now, that's not going to happen overnight, but you'll get a different industrial mix. And maybe these Silicon Valley companies will have a smaller footprint in cities, but that makes room for some other other industries, even such as my own, more universities located in cities.
So you're optimistic about sort of the, I don't know if they're the creative gales of destruction because they're sort of instigated by government policy. But you're pretty sanguine about the future of cities. There may be some rough patches economically, but the flight will provide opportunity for new entrants.
Yeah, and also these communication technologies, they kind of give you a connection to the city. So you may, because of Zoom and things like that, you get partners who are around the world, and the city can be the place where you meet. Now, maybe you're not there 40 hours a week. So that's part of what can bring these other industries into the cities, because they're becoming a more of a wide-ranging business in terms of their customers and employees, and the city is a great place to meet up and coordinate and share some assets.
You and a colleague recently wrote about fentanyl overdoses, as we saw fatalities north of 100,000, the most in recorded history in 2021. What do a couple of economists and policy and domestic policymakers have to say about fentanyl overdoses? What's the intersection there?
Well, this is something that President Trump was concerned about coming into office. He put us kind of all to work on that. But the pandemic brought it to a whole other level and focused very much on young people. So it overlaps with what we were talking about. But dropping a lot of law enforcement, like in Cook County here, I'm sure you've talked about, very low levels of law enforcement, that's made fentanyl that much cheaper, that much more available. The government checks. You see, the fentanyl came in kind of two or three waves, in the same waves that the unemployment benefits came. The $600, remember, and then the $300. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but in the same weeks when those checks were hitting mailboxes, bodies were hitting the morgue.
Wow.
And it's the overall disruption of people's lives, especially young people's. COVID wasn't really going to get the young people, but disrupting their lives did. And that we see that in drugs especially, but also alcohol, car accidents, diabetes, heart issues for younger people. A lot of people had chronic conditions, and interrupting people's lives, sowing panic, really interrupted their normal self-care. And people are sicker because of it, and a number of them dead.
Yeah, I mean, their self-worth and just their whole sense of community was gone. So with this fentanyl, how much and I don't know if you studied this, and I'm sorry, but how much of it is coming from our porous borders from down south in Mexico?
Well, all of it in a sense. Now, some of it is ingredients for fentanyl come across, and then they get recombined, you know, okay, within the United States. But ultimately, it's sourced from Mexico. You know, where's it come before that? Some of it, China, India. Now, the folklore before the pandemic was, well, this all comes through so-called ports of entry. It's coming right down the highway. And we had seen that Customs and Border Patrol. We're seeing that a lot. Fentanyl will be put on a truck. The driver doesn't even know. And then the cartels will pick it up on the other side of the border.
Wow.
But we've had such a surge in fentanyl now. I got to believe that some of it is coming over the rivers and through the desert, and not just along the highways across the border.
Well, and you know, too, I mean, 108,000 deaths, but for every overdose death, you write, more than 100 people struggle with debilitating addictions to fentanyl and methamphetamine. And so now you think, oh, 100,000 people, that's terrible, but it's still a small fraction of the population. But now you're talking about 1 million people, disproportionately younger people, and you're talking about a real societal problem.
Yeah, especially with the meth. The meth is not as deadly. It's quite deadly in the sense that it's driving death statistics, but it's not deadly in the sense that for each person taking, fewer are dying. So there's lots of people on meth out there, tend to be homeless. In certain areas of the country, you have like literally a homeless army, and there's just massive numbers of them. It really ruins their brain with, well, their body may still be alive and they don't show up in my stats. It's ruined their brain, and they can't reenter life at all, or certainly not very easily. It's an incredibly destructive habit, and I'm afraid public policy is really ignoring it, sometimes abetting it.
You write that there should be a cancer moonshot, Operation Warp Speed approach to this crisis of overdoses, this addiction, this crisis of addiction. No, so what would that look like?
Yeah, well, innovation, the thing about innovation, we don't know what it's going to be, but we look back in the history of this is not the first health problem that mankind has faced or America has faced. We've had AIDS, we've had, you know, waterborne diseases in the past. And at first the attitude was, well, let's just stay away from that and take care of ourselves that way. But ultimately we really got the big progress in innovation, figuring out how to treat the disease, prevent the disease with new drugs or new infrastructure. And I have confidence in our innovators that they're come up with something. I know they're working on it. You know, what the ultimate thing will be, we don't know, because it's an innovation, just like on our energy in our energy industry. Innovation's been amazing, and it's always surprising the details of it.
I wanted to get your reaction to a matter purely economic, but still related to pandemic lockdown policies. This development where we see big retailers experiencing excess inventory, 26% increase in inventory since this time last year, reported last week, adding up to about $45 billion between S&P consumer indexes with a market value of at least $1 billion. Target, 43% increase in inventory. Walmart, 32% increase. Macy's, 17% increase. Costco, 26% increase. So on the one hand, you have a shortage problem, and this is attributed to the supply chain. On the other hand, you have these big retailers with excess inventory. How should we interpret that development?
I mean, normally we would say excess inventory, like, uh-oh, they overestimated their sales, because normally they're trying to really keep the inventories to a minimum so that costs are low and they can offer low prices. Now with the supply chain issues, that probably changes the inventory strategy, at least for a period of time, that they want to keep an inventory. It's got an extra cost, but at least they don't have to disappoint their customer with an empty shelf. So it's a little hard to know right now which of those two factors, you know, overestimating customer demand versus just trying to keep the shelves full.
He is Casey Mulligan, econ professor, University of Chicago, served as chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 18 and 19 under Trump, and the author of You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, so did you see the sequel to Top Gun?
I did not.
Uh-huh.
Is Kelly McGillis in it?
No, Kelly McGillis not in it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. You know what? I'm so mean.
She has not held
up. Is going to happen to you?
She has not held up as well as Tom Cruise has over the years.
Let me know if I ever Kelly McGillis.
I wasn't as big a fan of Top Gun as many people, although I hear the reviews are pretty good on Maverick. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I wasn't a huge Top Gun fan either.
Do you understand what Top Gun was actually about?
No, besides the love story, the instructor, you know, teaching, you know, the teacher instructor falling in love with your teacher, hot for teacher.
I don't think
I'm missing it.
You're missing it. That's the conventional
sorry,
interpretation.
Sorry, I took a red eye in and I'm not all here. I'll let you know when I show up.
Conventional interpretation. I think the more accurate interpretation.
Yes.
Was offered by none other than Quentin Tarantino. He explained the actual plot of Top Gun, the original Top Gun, to Eric Stoltz in the 1994 rom-com Sleep With Me. Here's what was actually going on in Top Gun, and maybe this will inform whether or not you want to see Maverick.
You know what one of the greatest scripts ever written in the history of Hollywood is?
What?
Top Gun.
Oh, come on.
Top Gun is f***ing great. What is Top Gun? You think it's a story about a bunch of fighter pilots?
Yeah, it's about a bunch of guys waving their d***s around.
It is a story about a man's struggle with his own homosexuality. That's it. That is what Top Gun is about, man. You've got Maverick, all right? He's on the edge, man. He's right on the f***ing line, all right? And you've got Iceman and all his crew.
Right.
They're gay. And they represent the gay man, all right? And they're saying, go.
go the gay way. Go the gay way. He could go both ways.
What about Kelly McGillis? Right?
Kelly McGillis, she's heterosexuality. She's saying, no. Go the normal way. Play by the rules, go the normal way. And they're saying, no, go the gay way. Be the gay way. Go for the gay way. All right? That is what's going on throughout that whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you can ride my tail anytime. Yes. And what does Maverick say? Maverick, you can ride my sword fight. Sword fight.
So that's
sword fight.
The end of the movie, right?
Oh.
You can ride my tail. They uh-huh. say you can ride my tail.
And it was a metaphor for something else.
So he goes the gay way. And he explains to him, Kelly McGillis.
Uh-huh.
She's like, go the straight way, go the straight way. And then she dresses up like a man. Remember in the elevator scene? She's
oh,
dressed up in
right,
the bomber jacket and the sunglasses, the hair back and the hat.
Yeah.
So she's trying to woo him to go the straight way, go the straight way, and then go the gay way, go the gay way, and he ultimately goes the gay way at the end. Not a commentary on Tom Cruise's personal life at all,
no,
just the plot
no,
of
yeah.
Top Gun. I just thought that was an important interpretation, again, from Quentin Tarantino. So you may want to factor that in as you view Maverick, if you haven't already. So Ricky Gervais... saying in the entertainment world for a minute.
Yeah.
Ricky Gervais has a new comedy special. And he's gotten in hot water before from the Neo-Jacobins for his ridicule of celebrities when he hosted the Oscars and so forth.
Oh, that's right.
But he's in hot water now with the Hollywood mob because of some of the jokes he made in his latest stand-up special, which just premiered on Netflix the end of last week. So same thing as what happened to Dave Chappelle is now happening to Ricky Gervais.
Ooh, but is he going to be able to survive?
I don't think he's not touchable. It's like Chappelle,
okay.
He's not touchable. It doesn't matter what you do. What's going to happen? He won't get another Netflix comedy special. And point of fact, it seems like Netflix is moving away from the Neo-Jacobins and towards comedians like Chappelle and Gervais because, you know, they need to make money.
Women. I mean the old-fashioned ones. You know, the old-fashioned women. Oh, God. You know, the ones with wombs. Oh. Those fucking dinosaurs. No, I love the new women. I know the new women. They're great, aren't they? You know, the new ones we've been seeing lately. The ones with beards and c***s. They're as good as... They're as good as gold. I love them. No, it's the old-fashioned. And now the old-fashioned, they go, oh, they want to use our toilets. Why shouldn't they use your toilets? For ladies. They are ladies. Look at their pronouns. What about this person isn't a lady? Well, his penis. Her penis, you f***ing bigot. What if he rapes me? What if she rapes you? You f***ing turf.
Oh, that's great.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
That's good comedy. And, you know, remember, you're talking about Ricky Gervais, who, like Chappelle, he's a man of the left. He's like a vegan, humanist, atheist, intellectual mess.
Oatmeal drinker.
The conservative Ricky Gervais. The comedy speaks for itself, but it doesn't. And so he made a point about it.
Like, a joke is a window to the comedian's true soul. It's just, that's just not the case. I take on any view to make the joke funniest. I pretend to be right-wing. I pretend to be left-wing. I pretend to be clever. I pretend to be stupid. Whatever makes the joke funnier without prejudice. Okay, full disclosure, in real life, of course I support trans rights. I support all human rights. And trans rights are human rights, you know? Live your best life. Use your preferred pronouns. Be the gender that you feel that you are. But meet me halfway, ladies. Lose the That's all I'm saying.
Lose the what?
Lose the penis.
Oh, okay.
But this is relevant because on a policy front, much less funny, K-12 government schools must put boys in, well, not just government schools, but also private schools that are on the free or reduced school lunch program. K-12 schools must put boys in girls' bathrooms to get federal lunch money.
Oh, come on.
What do you mean, come on?
So if they don't get, they're not going to get federal lunch money?
Yeah, this is the stick.
Well, I remember Hersey High School. They didn't want to do the eating healthy salad bar because they knew the food would end up in the garbage, and they got cut out of a lot of federal funds, but they still made it work.
John L. Seltzer, ED of the Indiana Non-Public Education Association. It seems to be playing politics with feeding poor kids, which is unfortunate because if a school feels like they cannot participate in allowing boys to use the girls' bathroom, locker room, it's in conflict with their mission or values. If a religious exemption is not granted, you're taking away a program that's feeding low-income kids. So, you know, I know this is au courant and fashionable, and then there's the imposition of it and the implication. If you're not on board with boys, men, too, I suppose, in your daughter's bathroom or locker room at school, then no school lunch money for the poor kids. Does that sound compassionate and tolerant and enlightened? I know. You're going to have to break a few eggs. You're going to have to starve a few children in order to get what you want. No, I get it. Sure. And this is here on the cusp of LGBTQIA month, which
starts tomorrow,
which is every day in this country these days. And you're going to have all these pride parades. You got one in New York where police are banned, uniform police banned.
What?
Yeah, of course. What do you mean, what? Like, you're surprised.
Yeah. Well, we haven't had a gay pride parade in 2 years here.
Yeah.
Are they going to ban the Chicago cops here? Because normally they have a float of gay police officers, too.
No uniform police. No uniform police in New York. And Mayor Adams, you know, he's all, oh, I'm so offended. But, of course, the parade will go on. In Aurora, also.
They're having a gay pride parade in Aurora.
They've been having a Richard Irvin Institute at the mayor of Aurora. You're a conservative reform candidate for governor, I'm told by the Combine.
Mm-hmm.
And you're told by the Combine. But you go ahead and believe it. Okay. You go ahead and go down this road with another flim-flam man who's adopting the label conservative reform for the purpose of trying to buffalo just enough Republican primary voters to get the nomination so he can lose to Jelly Belly because people don't like imitations. They'll go for the real thing. Gay Pride or Pride Parade, whatever they call it, in Aurora, which is underwritten by the city of Aurora, as well as Indivisible Chicago, Indivisible. These are Soros-funded professional Marxist apparatchiks that the city of Aurora is partnering with under Richard Irvin. Not allowing uniformed cops because, of course, it's unsafe for LGBTQIA to have uniformed cops around because uniformed cops, I guess, I don't know, they're an existential threat to LGBTQIA or some such thing. Leftist orthodoxy. Okay. Richard Irvin criticizing Aurora parade organizers for not allowing uniformed cops, just like Mayor Adams did in New York. Point of order. The city's funding it. The city's underwriting it. This is the flim-flam, two-step, you know, little two-step politics that's always played by combine politicians in this state. I'm upset about something that's happening that's under my charge, but I'm pretending that it's not under my charge. All I can do is publicly criticize while underwriting it, so I get a... I serve two constituencies that way, you see. It's Richie Daly standing at the podium and banging his fist, decrying the Chicago Public Schools as if he's not in charge of the Chicago Public Schools. And every mayor since doing the same thing, by the way. So that's what you have here. But I mean, that's fine. So Aurora taxpayers are underwriting this and are underwriting parade organizers, which includes the city of Aurora and thus Aurora taxpayers that are antagonistic towards your local police department. And police in general. Same thing's happening in New York City. Same thing's happening everywhere. And, oh, by the way, the kids, no. No free or reduced school lunch for those kids in schools that don't have men in your daughter's bathroom or locker room. This is the brave, new, tolerant, enlightened world. Mark on the Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I was just wondering if, since we're talking about this, I think this happened about a year ago, the father who defended his daughter being sexually assaulted in the girl's bathroom, I guess, in her school. If there's been, like, is he still, you know, is he, you know, what's going on with that whole situation?
You're talking about
him. He goes to jail. I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, you're talking about the guy in Loudoun County.
Yes, Loudoun County, Virginia. So, yes.
Yeah. I don't have, I mean, he's not in jail, and he's not going to jail. Thanks for the call, Mark. But I don't have the latest and greatest on how that case was adjudicated. But again, the idea that he was the problem at that school board meeting where he showed up to get answers after his daughter was sexually assaulted by a boy in the girl's bathroom.
Yeah.
And
he was wearing a skirt, I remember, but then he attacked her, and then he was removed and put at a different school and did the same thing.
The idea that the school board would take a dismissive posture towards him, or, you know, he was being obstreperous. What would you do? How animated would you be if your father, who couldn't get answers from the school, you show up to a public school board meeting to get answers publicly, and you still get no comment from the school board? They just sit there, you know, in their implacable way above those addressing them. You know, public comment section is for you to comment, but not for us to respond. And then he gets a little worked up, and he's the bad guy. Well, that's it. That's what we're doing. Oh, by the way, more scholarship for you to be on the lookout. NPR brings this to our attention. Yeah, it's something you can be sure that the kids will be reading at your school to celebrate LGBTQIA plus month, because you got to be an ally. Elliot Schreffer's new book, Queer Ducks and Other Animals, The Natural World of Animal Sexuality. So when you're not hearing about your teacher's sexual exploits in second grade, you can hear, you can read about how the animal kingdom is full of LGBTQIA plus animals. It's designed to be teenager friendly, filled with comics and humor, and accessible science on the diversity of sexual behavior in the animal world. Okay, so you can look for that. You can educate yourself, which we always encourage you do, about all the new and exciting genders that are available for your choosing, for the choosing of your family. For example.
What? Are there more now? Aren't there 74 or 75?
We try to get everybody up to speed. I know some people are still struggling adding the IA plus to the LGBTQ. So let's continue to work the newspeak, continue to get everybody using the proper terminology, familiar with the lexicon. Xenogender. Here's an example. This is from our friends at Libs of TikTok, which is just them identifying somebody who posted on this. Xenogender. And then the example is cake gender, to make it concrete for you. Here's something, again, for you to potentially adopt come tomorrow.
Okay, I would describe xenogenders as a gender that could not typically be described with terms such as masculinity, femininity, neutrality, androgyny, things like that. It's more of not how you relate to a particular gendered experience, but more of how you relate to things. For example, cake gender. I know a few people who personally use this. It's typically described as them feeling light and fluffy or sweet and warm, and it's not something that you could typically describe with the terms masculine, feminine, androgynous, etc. Another example of cake gender would be if someone feels like they have different layers or flavors to their particular gender.
Flavors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Flavor.
So, you know, cake gender is something cake? That you might think about under the... That's a subset of xenogender, as you heard. So LGBTQIAX plus. Why don't we add that? Let's just get ahead of it.
Well, and a quick follow up too. Remember how State Farm they were looking for people to hand out LGBTQIA plus children's books during, you know, Gay Pride Month? Well, that backfired on them big time. They had received thousands of phone calls from people who just don't want, you know, to have their company get involved politically and to push this agenda. And one of my friends said they called to cancel their insurance policy after all these years, and they said we're no longer going to be involved in that program because they were losing
yeah
thousands of people.
Yeah, I'd be sure to follow up there. That could be a posture they take with people who call to cancel their insurance. Meanwhile, they're continuing to gather books to be distributed at the local schools, like Queer Ducks and Gender Queer and all the other softcore porn that's being pushed by those with the agenda to sexualize children in the primary grades. I wouldn't take anybody at their word these days. Sorry. Frank in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. You know, I wonder how much all of this stuff is related to, I don't know if you read the book by Yuval Harari, Homo Deus, God Man.
Yeah.
And the idea of the singularity, you know, mankind merging with machine. And, you know, if you read that book and some of the stuff that they talk about, and some of it is, you know, sci-fi and futuristic, but, you know, some of it seems plausible that, in effect, you could become anything you want in the future. You could become whatever you want to be at any time you want to be. And I wonder how much of it, how much of this stuff is driven by that agenda and their futuristic thinkings of what we're going to be in the future.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Yeah, actually, Harari did an interview of 60 Minutes a year or so ago. I remember playing excerpts from it. It's interesting and frightening at the same time. And interestingly, Yuval Harari thought the same thing. Interesting and frightening at the same time.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.